Welcome to the Mojo Record Club.
Hello, I'm Andrew Mail, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, and brand new revelations. Welcome to part two, where we get to talk about our favorite current releases.
John, what is your record of the month?
Thank you, Andrew. The new album I've chosen, I've put this week in my notes, but it's this month, isn't it? Really? Is Perceive Its Beauty, Acknowledge Its Grace by the poster boy of the UK jazz renaissance, Shabaka Hutchings. Although actually, this record is just billed as Shabaka now. He seems to have dropped the Hutchings. Anyway, Shabaka Hutchings made his name as a pretty wild saxophone player, fronting Sons of Kemet, The Comet Is Coming, and Shabaka and the Ancestors, among a lot of other very fruitful multitasking across the British jazz community. But at the end of 2023, he officially retired as a saxophone player and redirected his energies instead towards a wide selection of wooden flutes from around the world. I've got a long list of them, which isn't to hand actually, but I did review this record at length for Mojo and spent an inordinate amount of time trying to distinguish the difference between Peruvian and Japanese wooden flutes. It's quite it's one of the more esoteric bits of music criticism that I've done of late, but quite a fruitful one. Anyway, this album is technically his first solo album. And it's also the second major ambient jazz flute album of the past few months, following Andre 3000's New Blue Sun. Like New Blue Sun, Perceive Its Beauty is a pretty subtle, nuanced, immersive listen. And I think it's got a lot more appeal than its seemingly niche kind of description might initially suggest. Sorry, I can't speak. As I was saying, I wrote a big, long review of it in the issue of Mojo with Pearl Jam on the cover. I'm very conscious I could go into quite torturous depths about it, really, take up far too much of our dear listeners' time. But I've made a quick list of elements that I find are really exciting on it. The fact that he's used an American band rather than the British players that he's been associated with, a bunch of people like Esmeralda Spalding and Carlos Nino. There's a real focus on his breath work, his kind of meditative breathing, and how that feeds into his practice of playing the flutes, which I found hugely interesting and spoke to him at length about. I think we're going to publish the full interview if you are interested in breath work on the Mojo website.
I think you could hear my dog doing some breath work.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry about that.
This is very much a niche concern of my part, I think. There's a sneaky last bit of saxophone on the record where he switches from clarinet to flute to sax and goes crazy for a minute or two on the track called Breathing. The influences, which are some are obvious with Don Cherry and Alice Coltrane, but some are maybe more surprising, like Joanna Newsom. He told me when I was chatting to him that Joanna Newsom's Ys was actually one of his favourite records, and you can definitely hear it on some of the tracks. Couple of great rap cameos by Saul Williams and Elucid from the brilliant Armand Hammer duo, Elucid, that don't feel like very contrived modernizations of jazz, but feel like very organic manifestations of the ideas on the record put into sort of poetic form. And right at the end, a cameo by his father, Anum Yapu, who was the designer of reggae sleeves in the 70s and 80s, but also a Rastafarian poet himself who made a record in the 80s and some books of poetry. And Shabaka somehow managed to trick his father into the studio to recite one of those poems, Song of the Motherland, to the music that he'd scored for it. And it's a very moving end of the record, very powerful way to...
Well, let's hear a little bit of it first. This is I'll Do Whatever You Want, featuring Andre 3000, Floating Points, and Laraji, written by Shabaka Hutchings and released on, appropriately enough, Impulse Records.
I'll
working as someone who was left somewhat cold by the Andre 3000 flute album, I absolutely love this. This feels like a record that is so much more than what felt to me with Andre 3000, which was kind of an aimless ambient drift. This feels coherent, composed, multi-layered. It's a kind of inward spiritual journey that actually works. My only kind of reservation, I think, is at times I was worried that British jazz might be entering its intelligent drum and bass period. And I'm braced for another Saturn's Returns or kind of, you know, LTJ Bookham or something, you know, that at the moment I am enjoying this noodly ambient flute jazz blip on the scene. But I just feel that kind of there's a danger in which it, I wonder how tolerant everybody is going to be of it. I wonder how many of these albums we can take before we start saying, can I have, please have some blasting sax back. And also I feel that I do worry that I think with this album, you can tell that it is composed and arranged by someone who is incredibly intelligent and his knowledge of jazz goes very deep. But I feel like it's an area that someone else could come in with less knowledge and just, you know, offer up something that is incredibly bland, you know, incredibly kind of background. So I like this, but I'd also like them to stop.
I have to confess, it has been a while since I played Saturn's Return, to put it mildly. So I can't quite, that I will defer to your comparison there. But my very faint memory of it from the, what must be nearly 30 years ago now, is that it was a very bombastic record.
Yeah.
And what was going on with a lot of that scene became, it lost the immediacy and the rawness of that drum and bass sound. Although I suppose, and it became very bombastic and overdone. And I suppose my fear for this scene is that it becomes blander I'm not a huge fan of Ezra Collective, and to me they remind me a little bit of that sort of wine bar-ish kind of 80s acid jazz stuff that never quite stuck with me. It's like if there's a 90s drum and bass analog to this record, from memory, it reminds me more of those very zen Fotech records.
Yes, absolutely.
Which I loved and still do love. And even some of the Omnitrio records, although I don't think the comparison is quite as salient. But no, I think there's a risk. I know what you're saying about the Andre 3000 record, and a big part of that record and a smaller part of this record was the contribution of the percussionist, producer, and sort of all-round vibes master Carlos Nino, who's involved in tremendous records and makes a lot of records himself with a lot of interesting people, which I find don't cohere particularly well. So there are wonderful moments, and as a catalyst for things. Like he produced and played on that wonderful Sandy Untuli record last year, which I thought was a superb record, which was just her singing and playing piano with him just discreetly rustling in the background, basically. And I do think, you know, this kind of music really does hit a sweet spot for me.
Yeah.
But I think, there is a danger of drift, of inexorable drift. And I'm not scared of self-indulgence by any stretch. But I think just there is a discipline and focus to this record.
Mm.
And also I think that Shabaka's dynamism and attack as a saxophonist had to a degree cornered him, put himself into a corner, really, because he had that very staccato honking style.
Yes, absolutely.
And, and which was often reflected rhythmically in the way that his bands followed him, especially Sons of Kemet, which I found was quite limiting.
Yeah.
And he was clearly technically a brilliant saxophonist, but it was almost like the energies expected of him was limiting him as a player, because
maybe this record will be more of a bridge between two worlds then. Maybe kind of at the moment it sounds like a completely fresh start, but maybe one of the ways to look at it is kind of that it's more like a staging post to somewhere else, you know, because it's very easy, because of how dramatic the shift is, it's very easy to see it as a completely fresh start. But maybe what we're looking at is the beginning of, you know, kind of something exploratory, but not, you know, to use that in its pejorative sense, you know, that it's actually kind of, it's someone trying to find a new means of expression and a new way of expressing themselves.
Yeah. I also think, well, at one point that actually maybe he doesn't assert as much as one would expect is that we all see him as a saxophone player first and foremost. He kind of sees himself historically more as a clarinetist, because that was his first instrument, and that was the first one that got him his kind of, you know, his entry into professional musicianship, I think. And so, you know, there's an argument that actually if you see him as a clarinetist, this isn't as far a step away from what he was doing as if you see him as this blasting kind of jazz punk kind of saxophonist player, you know.
Absolutely. And maybe kind of the clarinet is still there in, you know, his back pocket, and that's something that kind of, because you could definitely see that as the midpoint instrument between the kind of two worlds that he's occupied.
Yeah, I mean, so. I love this record, and it's one of my favourite records of the year so far. Do I want him to make another 6 records like this? I'm not sure I do, but I'll take another 3.
Yeah, I'll take this one. I'll take this one.
You're listening to the Mojo Record Club. Okay,
so my pick for this episode is Mayday, the third studio album from the much-lauded French-Canadian singer and guitarist Myriam Gendron. Mayday is, of course, a word with two meanings. One, announcing the hopeful start of spring. He looks out the window. And the other, a cry for help. And both ideas kind of unite.
He looks out the window as well.
Yeah, exactly. Also looks out the window. And both ideas unite in this beautiful collection of variegated folk songs, some happy, some deeply sad, some sung in English, others in French. So it's an album caught. It's an album caught somewhere between Catharsis and Lullaby. And it's, interestingly, it's recorded with the free folk guitarist Marisa Anderson, and also Dirty Three drummer Jim White. And it's an album that kind of musically sits somewhere odd between the soothing and the uneasy. If I had a complaint, I'd say that it's curiously sequenced, perhaps purposefully so. It doesn't allow you a smooth passage through the album. It presents itself more as a puzzle or a challenge than some simple excursion into the intimate world of the folk-inflected singer-songwriter. It's almost as if Myriam Gendron knows what comes most easy to her and is trying to move away from that. And the process of moving away and the way in which she plays with these kind of free musicians, you know, like she's played with Chris Corsano in the past as well, is really fascinating. But if you know her previous two albums, you'll be aware of how that she is moving away from that kind of secure, intimate, comforting world of, you know, French Canadian folk song. Anyway, here is a taster of the track Long Way Home, written by Myriam Gendron and released on Thrill Jockey in the UK.
It's been a long way home, and I'm afraid the fire's gone. I just wanna be alone. It's been a long way home. I'll ride a sigh, a very sigh. sad song. All right,
I think what you were just saying before we played that about that, I don't know, I can't remember exactly what word you'd say, but there's something destabilizing about it. And it comes down, a lot of it, I think, comes down to the unorthodox rhythms of Jim White and the fact that it makes, in a way that we normally expect drummers to anchor a song, his free playing often seems to unanchor a song. And so something which feels very seductive and orthodox is suddenly thrown off kilter. And a lot of the time that works fantastically well. But sometimes it can be subtly jarring, and sometimes you can't always notice quite what isn't right about a song. And it's that discreet unsettling, which is a very effective way of subverting singer-songwriter tradition, I think. And that's maybe my favourite thing about this record, because I find it quite weird, this record, or I find my response to it quite weird, I think, because intellectually and everything about it, I can tell it's a really, really good record, and it's the sort of thing that historically I've loved. But I feel, for whatever reason, and I'm not clear remotely what that reason might be, that these kind of records, these singer-songwriter records that feel candlelit and super intimate, even with that little bit of dissonance created by the improvising musicians, just aren't quite working for me at the moment. And like I say, I think I'm very self-aware that it's my problem, not hers. And I think sometimes this is a real shortcoming of music criticism and a problem where sometimes you just have to walk away from a record and say, I'm trying to create an illusion of objectivity about this record. And when I have that kind of mindset, I can see how good it is and critique it in a really strong way. But actually, there's something about my state of mind that means I just don't really want to play this record a great deal.
Yeah.
However much I can appreciate it. And I know that's a bit of a self-indulgent prism through which to kind of critique a record, but I think it makes it, maybe the way that this record sound actually accentuates that response.
Yeah.
Or makes you more self-aware about that response.
I think so. I think it's a record that causes you to kind of question your response to it, because you think, as you say, there's so many things here that suggest kind of safety and comfort and warmth and intimacy. And yet there are other things there that are confounding that and upsetting that. And I think it's inevitable that you listen to a record like that and think, what is stopping me from engaging with this? You know, is it on the part of the creative musicians, or is there something else? And I would say that there is something intelligent going on here in terms of what they're doing with the music. But I would also say that I think there's something about the way in which the record is sequenced that also stops what I think is a very necessary flow that needs to be there. And a kind of going back to what Richard Thompson was talking about in terms of that sense of, like, you know, that even in the musicality of it, there is a storytelling quality that sort of pulls you through and kind of takes you on a sort of journey. And we've just come out of the Shabaka album, which is very intent on doing that. It's a sonic, you know, it's an audio journey. You know, you kind of begin at one point and you are caught up in the drift, and then you come out the other end.
Yeah, Shabaka even titled the songs to read as a poem.
Yeah.
If you take the titles, then it's meant to create a poem. So, yeah, exactly.
And I think kind of with the, I'm fascinated in terms of what she's done so far. I love what she's done so far. I do really like this album. I want to hear what she's going to do next. But there is a real sense there, I think, of almost a kind of a sense of kind of just discontent with, you know, kind of what she is brilliant at, almost, you know, that there's a sense of trying to find new ways to do something with this incredible skill that she has.
It's interrogating the idea of being a singer-songwriter and having an acute discomfort with being pigeonholed as such.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think if that is, if you approach the record in that way, I think you're going to find it absolutely fascinating. And I think also in this, is this day and age of kind of, you know, making playlists and kind of, and separating out tracks, there will be tracks that you fall in love with as singular moments and individual sort of tracks. But how you wrestle with the album as a whole, I think, is going to be really interesting.
Yeah, and I should say, for all of my, like I said, I tried to frame my misgivings as very personal, irrational responses. I do think, please give this record a go, because it's, yeah, I suspect it will be worth many of your time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, you've been listening to John Mulvey and myself, Andrew Mayle. That was the Mojo Record Club. And we hope to see you at the next one. You can all join in. And look in the episode description for full details of all the tracks we played. And don't forget to like and subscribe.
Thank you for listening to the Mojo Record Club.
Electronically rechanneled to simulate stereophony.